Our guest tonight is Tom Berger, one of Canada and British Columbia's most distinguished counsel. Mr. Berger has been active in public life in a variety of capacities for many years. He has been a member of the BC Legislature, a member of Parliament, and a judge of the Supreme Court of British Columbia. He conducted the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Inquiry, which challenged conventional notions of economic development in the North and established the Aboriginal communities there as important stakeholders in Northern resource development. He chaired the Alaska Native Review Commission, and he also investigated the impact of a proposed hydro development in India, which had serious impacts on indigenous people living in the large reservoir basin of the dam. That was an assignment for the World Bank, which prompted a re-examination of bank policies towards such developments. Perhaps his most important litigation as counsel was the Calder case in the early 1970s, which advanced a claim for Aboriginal rights on behalf of the Nisga'a people. The case ended in the Supreme Court of Canada with a divided court and an apparently inconclusive result. But Calder proved to be the catalyst that put Aboriginal rights on the national agenda, leading to the recognition and entrenchment of those rights in the 1982 Constitution, and more recently to the Nisga'a Treaty and the other treaty-making processes. Mr. Berger has continued to be actively involved in claims advanced by Aboriginal and Métis people, as well as in a broad range of other litigation with major social policy implications. His topic tonight is taken from the title of a book that has just been published, and copies are available at the table in the foyer, and you might be able to have a copy signed by the author at the end of tonight's lecture. The topic is One Man's Justice, the Law and the Struggle for a Just Society. Mr. Berger.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here this evening to speak to the Vancouver Institute, and I'm amazed that the book I just finished about 3 weeks ago is already in print and for sale here tonight. As a sometime author, that's absolutely bloody marvelous, I can tell you. Well, I would like to talk to you this evening about one man's perspectives on the immense changes in the law since I entered law school here on the UBC campus in 1953. It's 49 years since then, and thank heavens I was invited to come tonight and not next year when it would have been half a century. But I was a law student here at the law school for 3 years, then a lawyer, and I'm still a lawyer, though I served 12 years on the Supreme Court of British Columbia as a judge. I've been a law teacher occasionally at UBC and UVic law schools. So I've had a chance to look at developments in the law over the last 49 years from a number of points of view, and I should add that I was even once a client. And that offers still another perspective on the law. Now, 49 years is an awfully long time, you may say, but I've had time off, as Ken McKenzie has just told you. I was in politics, not very successfully, in the 1960s. I spent 3 years in the Canadian Arctic in the late 70s conducting the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Inquiry, and then 2 years in Alaska in the 80s, conducting the Alaska Native Review Commission, and then in India for much of 1991 and 92 as deputy chairman of a commission established by the World Bank. This time off, I really think, was important in because I have always been a lawyer. I've always thought of myself as a lawyer. And it meant that when I was away on these assignments, I always looked forward to returning to law. It didn't become jaded, but each time felt a renewed sense of engagement. So I want to talk a little bit about the progress of the law as I have observed it over those 49 years. And the title of my lecture tonight is the Law and the Struggle Towards a Just Society. That phrase, the just society, originated with F.R. Scott, the great legal scholar and advocate and poet who served as Dean of Law at McGill University in the 60s, who was a mentor of Pierre Trudeau's. The phrase itself, the just society, is now associated in our minds with the name of Pierre Trudeau, and it is not an empty phrase, and certainly is one in which he believed, because he is a major player in tonight's story. Well, let me just offer a few observations about the changes in the law and in the legal profession. When I graduated in 1956, there were 60 of us in our graduating class, and only three of us were women. Today, women constitute 50% or more of the student body of every law school in the country. 50% of the judges on the BC Court of Appeal, of the full-time judges, are women. On the Supreme Court of Canada, three of the nine judges are women, and of course, the Chief Justice is British Columbia's own Beverly McLaughlin. When I went to law school in the 50s, there were very few minority students. All of that has changed. In fact, Ujjal Dosanjh, a law graduate of UBC, became in 2000 the first Indo-Canadian premier in Canada. In the 1950s, when I went to law school, there was only one Aboriginal person who was a law student, and we had not graduated any First Nations persons as lawyers. Today, at UBC's law school, we have 42 First Nations students in the LLB program, two in the Masters of Law program, and one, indeed, a young Native person from Alaska named Daly Sambo, who worked with me back in the 80s on the Alaska Native Review Commission in the doctoral program. And those figures tell a story about immense changes that have occurred in that time. Well, I was called to the bar in 1957, and in those days, perhaps the most controversial rulings that were made by judges were in labor disputes. Cases involving strikes, picketing, injunctions came before the courts. And the judges, I think it's fair to say, were ill-equipped by background or sympathy to consider them in any adequate sort of way. And since 1973, 90% of all of those disputes have gone to the Labor Relations Board, a specialized tribunal equipped to deal with them. Well, in any event, in 1957, not many of the judges who were hearing these labor disputes were socialists, and not many sympathized with the trade union movement. And at least one of the judges had an anti-union bias. And he made no bones about it. His name was Justice A.M. Manson. And when I was new to the bar, I appeared before him. I represented iron workers who had been building what is now the Iron Workers Second Narrows Memorial Bridge. In 1958, while under construction, the bridge collapsed, and 18 iron workers were killed. The next year, 1959, construction on the bridge was continuing, and the iron workers went on strike. Judge Manson ordered them back to work. They didn't go. The judge held a hearing to consider whether they should be held in contempt of court. The question of the safety of the bridge was at the center of the dispute. The men said it was unsafe to go back. The company said it was safe. The company relied on an affidavit by Colonel Swan of Swan Wooster Engineers, a Vancouver engineering company. He said it was safe. I argued on behalf of the iron workers that the court couldn't rely on the affidavit of Colonel Swan because it was Colonel Swan's own company, Swan Wooster, which had just been found the year before to have been guilty of negligence in the collapse of the bridge and the loss of life. Judge Manson solved that problem. He said he knew Colonel Swan, had known him for many years, and that he was one of the finest engineers in the province. Well, one of the rules of the courts is that judges are not entitled to rely on private knowledge. They have to rely on the evidence that comes before them. If it were otherwise, you wouldn't need to call evidence, and the outcome would simply depend on who the judge knew or who knew the judge. At one point, Judge Manson called the iron workers who had refused to go back to work before him one by one, and he cross-examined them with a view to determining whether he should hold them in contempt. When I objected to this procedure, he threatened to hold me in contempt. And I remember this occasion not simply because he threatened to hold me in contempt for simply doing what the Court of Appeal later found was my duty as a lawyer, but it provoked an outburst. There were 100 iron workers in the courtroom, and they realized the judge was biased against them, that he was prosecuting the case on behalf of the company, and there was an outburst and shouts from the men in the courtroom. And it was deplorable in the sense that the judge had lost control of the courtroom. And the judge didn't hold me in contempt, but he did hold the union and its officers in contempt and sentenced them to imprisonment and to payment of fines. It was overturned by the Court of Appeal, but it was an egregious example of the weaknesses, I think, of the bench in those days. Now, pretty soon that sort of bias was on the way out. In 1969, 10 years later, I represented the trainmen who manned the trains from the Kootenays to Roberts Bank, carrying coal to Roberts Bank. And the service had just been initiated, and the coal cars, when they came to Roberts Bank, were inverted, turned upside down, unloaded onto ships, and then the cars were placed back on the railway. And the union insisted there had to be a brake test of those cars before they headed back up into the Kootenays. And the CPR agreed, but then the union claimed the company had resiled from its agreement, there had been no brake test, and they went on strike. The CPR went before Mr. Justice William McIntyre, who was a trial judge in those days, seeking an injunction to end the strike. Once again, the courtroom was crowded with 100 or more of the trainmen. But Justice McIntyre was even-handed. Everyone in the courtroom realized this was a judge who would be guided by the evidence. In this charged atmosphere, there wasn't a murmur from the rows of the trainmen sitting in court. In the end, Justice McIntyre held that the CPR had, by reneging on its agreement to hold brake tests, failed to come to court with clean hands. He refused to grant an injunction, and I recall that the president of the CPR was on a plane from Montreal that night coming to Vancouver to settle the strike. But Justice McIntyre was guided by the law and by the evidence, which is what judges are supposed to do. And when I served as a judge between 1971 and 1983, one of my colleagues was a judge named David Verschere, a very literate, convivial man who never took himself altogether seriously. We used to go often to lunch together. And one day I dropped into his office to suggest we go to lunch. He was hearing a very high-profile case in the newspapers, and he was writing at his desk. And I said, David, what are you going to do in that case? What's your decision going to be? And he kept writing, and he said, you know, Tommy, I can't wait to see how it turns out. And I found myself that on the bench, if you took that approach, it always was a bit of an adventure to see how it turned out. Well, we had capital punishment in those days when I was called to the bar. And in 1958, I defended my first murder case. I had been less than 2 years at the bar. It was a quite awful responsibility since your client could be hanged. I should add that I was successful. But even then, John Diefenbaker was the prime minister, even then the federal government was beginning its policy of commuting death sentences to life imprisonment. And that policy of commuting death sentences continued under the Pearson administration and under the Trudeau administration. In fact, the last hanging in Canada occurred in 1962. Capital punishment, generally speaking, was formally abolished in 1976, except for treason and assassinating the head of state. And in 1998, Canada became what in these circles is called absolutist. We abolished capital punishment for every offense, including treason and assassinating the head of state. We had habitual criminal legislation in those days. From 1947 to 1977, we had a provision in the criminal code under which an habitual offender could, after four convictions, be sentenced to preventive detention, that is, life imprisonment. In the 1960s, the Vancouver City prosecutor, the late Stuart McMoran, cast that net very wide. And I represented a number of men charged as habitual criminals facing life imprisonment, and one of them, who had a long record for shoplifting, stole a can opener at Woodward's and was sentenced to life imprisonment as an habitual criminal. We went to the Supreme Court of Canada, and there we were successful 5-4. So it was a narrow escape from a verdict that really, I think, would have brought shame on the justice system. In British Columbia, under the habitual criminal legislation that was in force for 30 years, the only three prosecutions ever brought against women were brought here in Vancouver. They were brought against three prostitutes who were prosecuted as habitual criminals. I was engaged in defending prostitutes and drug addicts at that time. And I represented each of these women. None of them were sentenced to life imprisonment, but it was at the time, in my view, quite remarkable that we should have been engaged in bringing the vast engine of the justice system to bear on these unfortunate women. I had a small office in the old Inns of Court building on Georgia Street. The rent was $120 a month, and my mother, who was a widow, worked for me, and she never said anything about my law practice in those days, but or at all, but during this efflorescence of prostitution in my practice, she said to me quietly one day, "Tom, do you think this is the best way to build a law practice?" Well, I suppose it wasn't, but it was an exciting time. In 1977, Parliament repealed the habitual criminal legislation and replaced it by dangerous offender legislation, which is limited in its application to offenders with a demonstrated capacity for violence. And perhaps I should say that these trends in the use of imprisonment are important. Canada today has a lower per capita prison population than the United Kingdom, and it's worth bearing in mind that the United States and Russia each have seven times as many prisoners incarcerated on a per capita basis as Canada does. In those days, legal aid was in its infancy. It was dependent on the willingness of the bar to do cases on a pro bono basis. The legal profession, to its credit, organized a legal aid program, but it was not until 1974 that substantial money came from the provincial government to enable people who couldn't afford a lawyer to engage a lawyer if they were charged with a crime and facing imprisonment. You may think that's fundamental, but it wasn't until 1974 that the province came on board. Legal aid was extended from one category to another over a period of time. In 1991, I represented a refugee named Gonzales Davy, a Guatemalan refugee, entering Canada, and the immigration bar asked me to go to the Court of Appeal to persuade them that refugees entering Canada through British Columbia were entitled to legal aid under the legal aid plan, and the Court of Appeal held that they were. That cost, each year after that, since 1991, $3.5 million in public funds. But of course, the refugees, like persons ordinarily charged with a crime, were liable themselves to be imprisoned. Last year, the legal aid program cost $88 million. Now, you know that it's been reduced this year to $54 million, but I think that this may run into trouble in the courts. In Ontario, where legal aid has been reduced, there have been a number of decisions by the Ontario courts holding that it is a breach of the right bestowed by the Charter of Rights, the right to counsel, to effectively deny an accused person the assistance of counsel because the province isn't prepared to fund the legal aid program. Well, these developments in the law help us to comprehend what a just society ought to be. Now, I appreciate that some may say that a just society entails a right to decent housing, to food on the table, to employment, protection from abuse, and so on. Well, I think in principle I would agree, but tonight I'm talking about incremental steps in the progress of the law. Because we've made room for women and minorities and First Nations people in the profession, we've abolished capital punishment, we no longer try to put petty offenders away for life, we provide legal aid to all who need it, The best example of that is the Air Canada case. We do not regard the prison system as an industry to be nurtured and expanded. And these are milestones, I think, on the path to a just society. Well, in a way, these are local matters, you'll have to forgive me that I raided my book for this lecture. So since my book is largely about myself, the lecture thus far has largely been about cases I've done. But let me turn to the national scene, to the work of the Supreme Court of Canada, because that is where the law is made. I was a trial judge for 12 years. I left in 1983, and the Law Society agreed that I could return to practice in the courts in 3 years, and I spent that 3 years in Alaska conducting the Alaska Native Review Commission. But when I did return, I fussed over the question, well, I wrote a lot of judgments in those 12 years on the bench. Now I'm going back into the courts. I'm going to be arguing cases. I was afraid that I might have to rely in argument on some of the judgments I'd written, or that worse still, they might be cited against me and I'd have to explain that they were not worth bothering about. Well, I needn't have worried. All of those judgments appear to have drifted down a black hole and have not been read or heard of since. Well, the point I make is that I was a trial judge, and it is appellate judges, the judges on the Court of Appeal of each province and the judges on the Federal Court of Appeal, but especially the judges on the Supreme Court of Canada who really make the important decisions about the path of the law. Now, the Supreme Court of Canada has played an important part in the unfolding of the debate about national unity in Canada. I refer, of course, to the decision in the patriation reference in 1981. That is when Prime Minister Trudeau referred the question of the constitutionality of his proposed new constitution and charter of rights to the Supreme Court of Canada, and they made a decision that I needn't go into, but it strongly influenced the final form of the charter, especially the inclusion of the notwithstanding clause. And then in 1998, the Supreme Court of Canada dealt with the secession reference. You may remember that that was the case in which the question was referred to the Supreme Court of Canada, could Quebec separate? Under what conditions could it separate? And the most important part of that judgment, I think, was that the Supreme Court of Canada said, yes, a province could secede from the Federation, but that it had to put a clear question to the electorate. And that was a reflection on the questions that the government of Quebec had put to the Quebec electorate in the referendum of 1980 and the referendum of 1995, because those were not clear questions. They were questions designed to elicit a yes answer, the answer the government wanted. The Supreme Court of Canada said, no, that's not good enough. You have to put a clear question, yes or no. Are you in or out, in favor of independence or not? And that led to the adoption by the federal government of the Clarity Act, which really provides that Canada will not consider the outcome of a referendum in Quebec unless it is the result of a clear question. And we in BC are no longer innocent of how questions can be framed in a referendum. And there are some uncharitable souls who believe that the questions that were posed on the referendum on the rights of Aboriginal people in May were calculated to produce the answers the government wanted. Well, I think that the Supreme Court's two greatest tasks in recent years have been the interpretation of the Charter of Rights and the elaboration of the meaning of Aboriginal rights and treaty rights, following upon the passage of the Constitution Act in 1982. The Charter and Section 35 both were enacted in 1982. Both became part of the Constitution, but Section 35 is not part of the Charter. Section 35 is, however, if you will, the Charter of Rights of the Aboriginal Peoples of Canada. Now, in discussing the Charter, it shouldn't be thought that in Canada there was a legal wasteland before the Charter came into force in 1982. In the 1950s, Justice Ivan Rand, a great judge in the Supreme Court of Canada, in a series of judgments upholding the rights of Jehovah's Witnesses in Quebec to proselytize without being tried for sedition or turned off the streets or having their liquor licenses canceled when they put up bail for their co-religionists, laid the groundwork for for consideration. I wonder, do we have such a thing as a glass of water here? I know the Institute is thinks of everything, but he laid the groundwork for consideration of freedom of speech and freedom of religion as fundamental freedoms in cases called Boucher, Somer, and Roncarelli and Duplessis. And in 1960, John Diefenbaker brought in the Canadian Bill of Rights. It wasn't entrenched in the Constitution, and it applied only to federal legislation. But it got us used to the idea of cataloging human rights and fundamental freedoms. It was a precursor of the Charter of Rights. And I venture to say that if Pierre Trudeau is the father of the Charter of Rights, John Diefenbaker may be considered the grandfather of the Charter of Rights. Now, the Charter came into force in 1982, and 3 years later, in 1985, the Supreme Court of Canada gave an expansive interpretation to Section 7 of the Charter, which provides that no one shall be denied life, liberty, or security of the person except in accordance with the principles of fundamental justice. The court decided that that meant more than simply considering the fairness of the procedure by which the law was applied. It meant the courts could judge the law's substantive content to determine how far it conformed to Section 7. That's all fairly technical, but you will remember that in 1988, the Supreme Court of Canada in the Morgenthaler case struck down Canada's abortion legislation as unconstitutional, and that was based on the interpretation of Section 7 of the Charter. The much of the Charter litigation, thanks, much of the Charter litigation has to do with the rights of accused persons, and that could be the subject of a whole winter of lectures. I want to mention the Chambers case, which I took to the Supreme Court of Canada in 1990, which established the right to silence. That is, when the police arrest you and they say, as you've heard them say on television time and time again, you have the right to remain silent, you don't have to say anything, but anything you say may be taken down and used in evidence. Well, the Chambers case was one in which the Supreme Court of Canada laid it down that the right to silence means the right to silence, and you can never be taxed at your trial with your failure to offer an explanation to the police. They told you had the right to be silent. That's something that means that you can't ever be asked at your trial. Why did you just come up with this explanation today? Why didn't you tell the police back then? I also went to the Supreme Court of Canada in the Dersch case, which established the right of accused persons to see the evidence used by the law enforcement authorities to obtain wiretap orders for purposes of challenging the introduction of wiretap evidence. I only mention this because there is a tendency in the law that has grown stronger over the years to require the law, the police and the law enforcement authorities to abide by the law. And this was a case in which the court said, well, when they go to get a wiretap, the affidavits they use to get the wiretap order must be disclosed in a court at the trial to determine whether the wiretap was lawfully obtained. And I only mention that case because I argued it in the fall of 1989, and the Berlin Wall was just coming down. And I said to the court, and I think it was a legitimate thing to say, this desire to replace the rule of secrecy with the rule of law is something we can see manifesting itself in Eastern Europe today. And we in Canada shouldn't turn our backs on that principle. Well, could I just mention linguistic rights, because it doesn't often arise in British Columbia, but one of the provisions of the Charter of Rights, Section 23, provides that minority language education must be provided out of public funds where numbers warrant, and that protects the Anglo minority in the province of Quebec and the Francophone minorities in all the English-speaking provinces. And the Supreme Court has given this an expansive interpretation in a case called Arsenault Cameron that came from Prince Edward Island in 2000. The Prince Edward Island government had approved for the Francophone minority in the town of Summerside in PEI. They said, yes, we will provide instruction in the French language for Francophone students, grades 1 to 6 in Summerside. But we won't do it in Summerside. They have to take the bus to another town called Abrams Village, which would take an hour each way. And this went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. The Francophone minority said, no, we want the classes here in Summerside. This is where we live. And the Supreme Court of Canada held that Section 23 of the Charter conferred a right on the Francophone community in Summerside to have their children educated in their mother tongue in their own community. That Section 23 was intended to enable the Francophone community in Summerside to survive and to flourish. Education wasn't something that occurred independently an hour's drive away on the school bus. It occurred right within the community, and that the charter was intended to enable those minority communities to flourish. And they held that they had to establish minority language education facilities in Summerside and not simply provide a bus ticket to go to another town. Well, I would like to discuss now the most, what I think is the most important provision of the Charter of Rights, which has elicited the most important litigation of recent years. Section 15 of the Charter says, and forgive me, I'll just read this out, every individual has the right to the equal protection of the law without discrimination, and in particular without discrimination on the ground of race. You can't discriminate on these grounds. On the ground of race, national or ethnic origin, color, religion, or sex. And by sex today we would say gender. You can't discriminate as well on the ground of age or physical or mental disability. Now, Mr. Diefenbaker's Canadian Bill of Rights had a similar provision, but it was interpreted in a way that in most cases deprived it of any force. In a case called Gonzales in 1963, I went to our own Court of Appeal here to argue that the provision of the Indian Act, which made it an offense for an Indian off a reserve to be in possession of liquor, to be in possession of alcohol, was discrimination on the grounds of race and offensive to the Canadian Bill of Rights. But the Court of Appeal held, and this was the conventional view in those days, that there was no discrimination on the ground of race because the law applied equally to all of those similarly situated. That is, as long as every Indian charged with possession of liquor off a reserve was dealt with in the same way, then there could be no discrimination. All those similarly situated were being treated in the same way. The law applied to all Indians, so there was no discrimination. The fact that all the non-Indians were not liable to prosecution for being in possession of liquor off a reserve had no bearing on the matter. Well, when the Charter of Rights came into force, and this particular provision did not come into force until 1985, the question arose in the Supreme Court of Canada in one of the most important cases I think they have ever decided. It's called Andrews. Whether that similarly situated test would be used under the Charter. And Justice William McIntyre is from British Columbia, the judge in the Trainman's case I mentioned earlier, was on the Supreme Court of Canada by this time, and he wrote the main judgment for the court, and he said the similarly situated test is one that should be rejected. And he pointed out it could have been used to justify Hitler's Nuremberg laws. All the Jews were treated the same under the Nuremberg laws. What's the problem? And this enabled the courts to move beyond a consideration of formal equality to consider substantive inequality. And thus women and minorities and Aboriginal people can argue that they are disadvantaged by such things as pregnancy, unequal pay, racism, and so on. Now, the most salient issue in terms of equality rights today relates to discrimination against homosexual persons. And I don't have to tell anybody living in Vancouver who knows about the way that the question of the rights of homosexual persons is roiling the Anglican Church, how important an issue this is in our country today. And when I read out the prohibited grounds of discrimination in Section 15, I don't know if that's the buzzer or the fan or what it is, but I'll carry on. When I read out those prohibited grounds of discrimination, there was one missing, that's sexual orientation. And in 1995, in a case called Egan, the Supreme Court of Canada held that the list of prohibited grounds was not exhaustive. That is, the list in Section 15 of the Charter was not exhaustive, and that it should be read on the basis that sexual orientation was one of those grounds as well. Now, many critics objected. They said the Charter of Rights doesn't say anything about sexual orientation. Who are you, you unelected judges, to add that? Well, the wording of Section 15 does not exclude other grounds being considered, and they said that sexual orientation was a ground of discrimination analogous to those actually listed in the Charter. Robert Bork, a well-known American jurist, and you will recall he was nominated to the Supreme Court of the U.S. about 15 years ago, and his nomination failed amid great controversy. But in 2002, he delivered the Barbara Frum lecture in the course of a speech lacerating the Supreme Court of the U.S., the Supreme Court of Canada, and the Supreme Court of Israel for socialist tendencies. He called the Egan decision, which provided that sexual orientation would be a ground of discrimination under Section 15, he called it extraordinary, and in this he spoke for a constituency, perhaps not a very large one, but a constituency of Canadian academics, very critical of the Supreme Court of Canada. 3 years later, in a case called Vrend, a truly extraordinary case, The Supreme Court of Canada found that Alberta's Individual Rights Protection Act violated Section 15 of the Charter because it did not include protection for homosexual persons. BC's Human Rights Act from 1993 included protection for homosexual persons. Alberta's did not. It was expressly excluded. The Supreme Court of Canada said that to fail to include protection for homosexual persons in your human rights law is itself a violation of the Charter of Rights, and they declared that Alberta's legislation should be read as if it included those provisions. Important developments that could not have been foreseen when I first entered the legal profession. It shows how the work of the Supreme Court of Canada in delineating the rights that we all enjoy under the Charter of Rights has embarked on a vast and, for the most part, quite impressive piece of work. Could I just add that in 2001, in the Trinity Western case, the Supreme Court, I think, failed to extend to homosexual persons the same measure of protection that they would in similar circumstances have extended to other minorities. It's a long story, but let me just, in a few sentences, tell you what occurred. Trinity Western is a university established in Langley by the Evangelical Free Church, and under its constitution, two-thirds of the Board of Governors are members of the Evangelical Free Church. They required faculty and students to sign what is a contract, for lack of a better word, in which they subscribed to a biblical condemnation of homosexual behavior, placing it in the same category as cheating, stealing, and the viewing of pornography. Now, it's a private university, and it can do what it wants and teach what it wants. That's certainly its prerogative. And they don't have any obligation to make homosexual students or faculty welcome. It's their business. But they applied to the BC College of Teachers for approval of a 5-year teacher education program qualifying their graduates, their B.Ed. graduates, to enter the public school system as teachers. And the College of Teachers said, no, you can have this program, but the fifth year, the students should spend some time at SFU in a public perspective than the teaching at Trinity Western, and where you'll meet students who may be rather more diverse than the student body at Trinity Western. No one said that these students would be proselytizing in the classroom. The question was whether they would be prepared, professionally prepared, to enter the public school classroom where you may have students who are homosexually oriented. You may have students accused of being homosexuals who are bullied by other students. You may have colleagues in the staff room who are homosexual. You may have students whose parents are of the same sex. These are facts of life today, and the college said, no, we just think these students won't be ready. Nobody said these students were not good young folks. It was a question of professional preparation. Well, the argument went to the Supreme Court of Canada, and the Supreme Court held on the main issue. Trinity Western had said, no, we have freedom of religion, and you can't look at what we teach because it's biblically inspired. It falls under the rubric of freedom of religion, and the College of Teachers has no right to consider what our religious beliefs are. The Supreme Court said, no, that's wrong. The college can look at your teaching program. But then the question arose, did signing this contract constitute evidence on which the College of Teachers was entitled to insist on the fifth year under the joint Trinity Western SFU program. And the Supreme Court of Canada said, no, it's insufficient evidence. They said that the college should approve the five-year Trinity Western program without requiring a fifth year under the auspices of the joint SFU-TWU program. And they said that there had to be evidence of intolerant behavior in the classroom by these graduates or some other deleterious effects in the classroom. The college all along had said, no, we are the people who know about the classroom, and we say that we are entitled to take every precaution to ensure that these teachers are professionally prepared to enter the classroom, that the welfare of the children is our first consideration. The Supreme Court said no. Well, in the course of that argument in the Supreme Court, I had said, what if you had a university? Consider the other prohibited grounds of discrimination in the Charter. What if you had a university that taught anti-Semitism or taught that blacks were inferior to other races? Would you have to wait until something untoward occurred in the classroom? Or could you say, you know, we don't think your program is one we can approve. We want these students to be exposed to a public university before they go out into the world. And Chief Justice McLaughlin asked the lawyer for Trinity Western. She said, what would you say if you have a university that teaches and sets out as part of its credo, the Jewish people have been responsible for many evils visited on the world? If that university applied for approval of its teacher education program, would you say that the college would have to wait for evidence? The college would have to wait for evidence? Or could they say, there's a danger here and we should step in preemptively? I thought that was a compelling way of putting the case, but in the end, it did not prevail. And, you know, there's an old saying about advocates that that we say, I've never lost a case that wasn't wrongly decided, but a year has passed since the Trinity Western decision, and I think that the Supreme Court stopped short of affording the same measure of protection to homosexuals that we can reliably predict they would have extended to other groups protected by the Charter. The Charter offers minorities a place to stand, ground to defend, and the Supreme Court has the job of securing that place and marking out that ground. And having determined in the Egan case in 1995 that homosexual persons are entitled to the protection of the Charter, shouldn't the court have followed the logic of its decision in Egan? And Madam Justice Claire LaRue DeBay, who retired just a month ago from the Supreme Court, who was its greatest champion of minority rights during her 15 years on the court, wrote, she dissented in our favor. We lost 8-1. She said, the principal metaphor for the homosexual experience of discrimination has been that of the closet, an isolated refuge of invisibility, often enveloped in fear. Indeed, the history of struggles against sexual orientation discrimination has been described as a battle against the apartheid of the closet. And I'm convinced that primordial fears and ancient stereotypes still inform our attitudes, as they used to do about women, about Jews, about Asians, about minorities of all types, about the disabled. And religious institutions continue to denounce homosexuality as perverse and unnatural, and the place of homosexuals as a vulnerable minority entitled to the protection of the Charter has not yet been fully accommodated in our consciousness. Well, I mention this to show that the elaboration of Charter rights is not going to be easy. We're not there yet. It extends over the horizon. And despite the heroic achievements of the Supreme Court of Canada in the last 20 years, it is a record that contains some setbacks for minorities. Well, could I conclude by talking just for a minute about the second great task of the Supreme Court of Canada in recent years. And it has to do with Aboriginal rights. And this is also a salient issue in the life of our country, and in particular in the life of our own province. But it didn't used to be that way. When I went to law school here at UBC in the 1950s, Aboriginal rights was not on the curriculum. We never heard anything about it. Professors, lawyers, judges had never studied the subject. And I had opened a small law office where I think I told you the staff consisted of my mother and my secretary. And I didn't have many clients when I started out, and I spent a lot of time in the library reading law, and I stumbled across what I thought was an important vein that had been overlooked, which led me to believe that Aboriginal rights was a subject we could develop in this province. And in 1967, on behalf of the Nisga'a Tribal Council, I brought an action against the province for a declaration that their Aboriginal title had never been extinguished. The case was not, I think, expected to succeed. And while the case was before the courts, while it was undergoing appeal, Prime Minister Trudeau was in Vancouver and was asked, "What do you think, sir, about Aboriginal rights?" And he said, "Our answer is no. We can't recognize Aboriginal rights because no society can be built on historical might-have-beens." Well, in some quarters in BC today, there's a nostalgic wish to return to the years when that view predominated. As Ken McKenzie said, the case was brought in the name of Frank Calder, who was at the time the president of the Nisga'a Tribal Council. The case was decided by the Supreme Court of Canada in 1973. It led to the recognition by the Trudeau government of the necessity to settle land claims throughout the country where there were no treaties. And as a result, since 1973, land claim settlements have been made in James Bay in northern Quebec, the Northwest Territories, Nunavut, the Yukon, and now with the Nisga'a Treaty beginning in British Columbia. And they cover half the landmass of the country. And that whole thing, if I may be forgiven for saying so, started out in that little law office in the old Inns of Court building. In 1982, when the Charter of Rights came in, there was added Section 35, which is not part of the Charter, but it is part of the Constitution, affirming the Aboriginal and treaty rights of the Aboriginal people. And it's something I won't go into tonight, but the first draft of the new constitution and charter included protection for Aboriginal and treaty rights. It was deleted at the last minute. I spoke out against that. I was a judge. Many thought I shouldn't, as a judge, have been speaking out on a controversial political subject. The result was that in 1983, I left the bench. But Section 35 was restored so that we have a constitutional provision recognizing and affirming Aboriginal and treaty rights, and it is enforced in the courts in this country, I'm sure, every day of every week. And indeed, in the year 2000, I would appear in the Supreme Court of British Columbia on behalf of the Nishka to urge successfully that the Nishka Treaty should be upheld as affirming Aboriginal and treaty rights, and indeed it was. Let me just say that at the time, there were people who thought that I, as a judge, was not qualified any longer to hear cases involving First Nations people. And Chief Justice McEachern of the Supreme Court of British Columbia, my Chief Justice, thought otherwise. At the time, my wife Bev was a counselor at the Native Indian Teacher Education Program here at UBC. And one evening while I was still on the bench, there was noise down below and a lot of talking and laughter, and then it subsided. I went down and said to Bev, well, what was that about? She said, some of the Native women who are students in the teacher education program at UBC are going downtown to occupy the offices of Indian Affairs. They're staying overnight and they wanted to borrow some kitchen implements. I said, oh, yes. Well, the next day, Chief Justice McEachern phoned me and said, there's an application for an injunction to remove some women from Indian Affairs offices. Would you hear it? And I said, Chief, no, I can't. I have a conflict. I'm afraid that as we speak, our frying pan is being held hostage at the, the Supreme Court of Canada, in a series of decisions since 1982, has elaborated the meaning of the protection in the Constitution given to Aboriginal and treaty rights. One of those cases is well known, I'm sure, to you, the Delgamuukw case arising here in BC, the Marshall case, which arose in Nova Scotia, and there's another case that you probably haven't heard of, but it's equally important, the Côté case from Quebec, in which Chief Justice Lemaire for the Supreme Court of Canada held that even if under the law of New France there had been no acknowledgement of Aboriginal rights, they could nevertheless be claimed as existing Aboriginal rights today. And he said this, he said, Section 35 would fail to achieve its noble purpose of preserving the integral and defining features of distinctive Aboriginal societies if it only protected those defining features which were fortunate enough to have received the legal recognition and approval of European colonizers. So you can see how, over a period of years, the idea of Aboriginal rights arising from Aboriginal use and occupation of the country before the Europeans came had become the conventional wisdom in the courts. Well, there is a postscript that I alluded to a moment ago. In all of these land claim settlements, the issue of Aboriginal self-government lurked in the middle distance, because if you settle all these land claims, as we have done throughout half the landmass of Canada now, if Aboriginal people enjoy the right to land, to hunt and fish, to use forestry and other resources, how are those lands and the people there to be governed? In the Nishka Treaty, it is provided that the Nishka Nation is to have the power of self-government. It's limited, it applies only in certain spheres, but it is accepted that it is a power of self-government they enjoy that can't be taken away from them. And Gordon Campbell, then the leader of the opposition, sued the Nishka to have the self-government provisions of the treaty set aside. And this was a dispute about which people held quite sincere views on both sides. Mr. Campbell on one side, the Nishka on the other side. These provisions were, he argued, unconstitutional. First Nations should resemble municipal governments, having only delegated powers from Ottawa and Victoria, which could be removed at any time. And Justice Paul Williamson of the Supreme Court of BC held against Mr. Campbell, ruling that Aboriginal people have an inherent right of self-government and that it applies in the case of the Nisga people to Nisga land, Nisga resources, and Nisga laws. You all know that Mr. Campbell appealed, but had the misfortune to become premier and then was advised that he should abandon his appeal since he couldn't be on instructing on lawyers on both sides of the lawsuit, because of course Canada and BC had joined the Nisga in resisting Mr. Campbell's lawsuit. And I think he was right to do so, because I think he recognized quite properly that the Nisga Treaty reached in 2000 between Canada, BC, and the Nisga people was an engagement of honor that had to be recognized by successive governments. Now let me say that in preparing the argument on self-government to present to Justice Williamson, we relied on what Prime Minister Trudeau had said in 1983, opening a First Minister's Conference to consider amendments to Section 35 relating to self-government. This was a First Minister's Conference at which Native leaders were invited in 1983 to consider self-government. And Prime Minister Trudeau said that since becoming Prime Minister, he had devoted more thought to this subject than to any other. And he said, and bear in mind what he had said in 1969, 13 years before, we can't recognize Aboriginal rights because no society can be built on historical might-have-beens. But in 1983, he said, the heart of the matter, the crux of our efforts to improve the condition of our Aboriginal peoples and strengthen their relationships with other Canadians is found within the set of issues concerning Aboriginal self-government. So Mr. Trudeau had much to do with our journey towards the just society, and the unfolding of his own understanding is mirrored by our own. And there has, I think, been progress by and large. I think all of the developments I've referred to have made this a better place to live. We have advanced farther along towards the just society than we were back in the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s, and the 1980s. At the same time, there has been continuity. We build on what has gone before, taking various strands from the past and weaving them into a pattern for the future. So let me conclude where I began by quoting F.R. Scott, who first coined the phrase, the just society. He said, if human rights and harmonious relations between cultures are forms of the beautiful, then the Constitution of Canada is a work of art that is never finished. Thank you very much.
Now we have an opportunity for questions.
One over here.
Yes. Following directly on your discussion of the Constitution, in Friday's Golden Mail, Stephen Clarkson of the University of Toronto wrote a piece that suggested that our Constitution has fallen under the authority of something he referred to as an external Constitution, instead of
Well, I wouldn't attempt to, but could I make a comment, please? Oh, yes. The question is whether we haven't, through the World Trade Organization, now have a new constitution that is external to our own country that in many ways supersedes the Constitution that I've been talking about tonight. Well, I know that's a question that deserves the most serious consideration. Could I just say that it is an important question whether with in an age of globalization where most industries now are global in their magnitude and where ownership may be far from British Columbia, the whole question of the jurisdiction of the British Columbia courts, the capacity of any person in British Columbia or even the government of British Columbia to obtain redress anywhere is a very real question. And I don't want to say any more than that because it's a vast subject and I don't pretend to know a great deal about it. But I think Mr. Clarkson, who wrote this article, did pinpoint something that should concern us all. But that should be one of the speakers next year at the Institute, I think. Well, we did that with homosexual behavior, which used to be a crime, and in some countries is still a crime, and some religious believers would have it reinstated as a crime. I mean, but that's a sincere belief that they derive from biblical authority, and many views are held based on the belief that they have been dictated by a supreme being of one kind or another. I think you're talking about drugs and marijuana, and you know, I've thought about that, and this is one of the great things about just being a lawyer, a private citizen. I don't have to have a view on that, and I don't, because my view keeps changing. One day I think this, and the next day I think, no, depends, you know, whether you're a parent, whether you're a teacher, whether you're a father, a grandfather, as I am, you think, well, that seemed like a good idea a while ago, but I'm having second thoughts about it. I know this is an inadequate answer, but I'm going to leave it to folks like you to work that one out. I think that's the question is about the Lovelace case, and that is a case that's, you know, I don't go around with all this stuff at my fingertips, but I think I can say that it's a case in which the non-status Indians, those who were of Indian descent by blood, but not registered as Indians under the Indian Act, claimed that they were entitled to the same benefits as Indians. The Supreme Court of Canada said, no, you're not. It's not. It may be a breach of your equality rights, but under Section 1 of the Charter of Rights, a violation such as this can be justified if it is a pressing matter from the point of view of the need for such legislation, and if it can be justified in certain other respects. It might, if someone else had been giving this lecture, they might have introduced it in the Aboriginal rights section of my talk and described it as the same kind of setback that I suggested the Trinity Western case represented in dealing with homosexual rights.
Yes. sentences for counseling or aiding in a suicide are likely to be liberalized to permit doctors to act under the provincial health directive, the representation agreement?
The question was about assisted suicide. In the Rodriguez case, a case involving a woman from Victoria, the Supreme Court of Canada in the early 90s held that assisted suicide could not be countenanced under the Charter of Rights. It was a 5-4 decision, and Chief Justice Lemaire, for the minority, laid out proposed legislation. He said, if Parliament wants to enact a provision for assisted suicide, here's how to do it. He really drafted the provision, and the Minister of Justice, who is contemplating a revision of the code, I gather, might turn to that for assistance. It's another very, very tricky question, and he may well make it part of the review. Well, yes. Well, everyone seemed to. The question is, what is the relationship between law and justice? The law is, I suppose, a little easier to pin down. And each of us has our own vision of what may be just. But I think that the Charter of Rights represents a consensus of Canadians now about what is just. I think the recognition and affirmation of Aboriginal rights is something that most Canadians regard as consistent altogether with the idea of justice. I think and since you mentioned my book, I will invite you, and you held it up. Thank you, sir. I will invite you to read the introduction in which I have suggested that every lawyer, not in every case, but in many cases, can do something to advance or retard the cause of justice. Sometimes you succeed, sometimes you fail. I think that it's an ever-receding objective. It keeps moving away the closer you think you're getting. And that's the relationship. We struggle in the vineyards of justice, but out there on the horizon, in the vineyards of the law, but out there on the horizon is our idea of justice. That's the best I can do.
It's funny, here I'm telling you all about my career as a lawyer, and inevitably the one thing that people know about me is that I did the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Inquiry. But when I completed the inquiry in 1977, the idea was to bring a pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to carry natural gas from Alaska through the Mackenzie Delta and south along the Mackenzie Valley to metropolitan centers in Canada and the USA. It was to be the largest construction project in something at the time. And I spent the best part of 3 years in the Mackenzie Valley in the Western Arctic and held hearings and wrote a report. In it, I said that we should never build a pipeline, because, of course, a pipeline in the north, it means infrastructure, it means roads, it means helipads, construction sites. It means everything that industrial activity brings in its wake. And I recommended that the federal government preserve forever a wilderness park in the northern Yukon to protect the Porcupine River caribou herd, which is one of the last three great herds in North America. And that was done. So there can never be a pipeline across the northern Yukon, across the calving grounds of the herd. The other recommendation I made was this. I said, we can bring natural gas from the Mackenzie Delta and the Beaufort Sea, Canadian gas, south along the Mackenzie Valley. And I said how that could be done. And I explained the route and set out the conditions under which it could be done. But I said, don't do it now because we have to settle the claims of the Dene and the Inuvialuit, who are the majority of people living in the region. And they objected to the pipeline. They said, settle our claims first so this whole thing doesn't come over us and trample us, leaving us behind. And I said, take 10 years to settle those claims, then you can build it. And that recommendation was adopted, and the pipeline still hasn't been built, and we've had 25 years, because it was 1977 that I completed that report. We've had 25 years, and the claims have been settled. More, not altogether, but I would guess, if you had to measure it, about 90% of the claims have been settled. And in fact, the Premier of the Northwest Territories, Steve Cacfui, is now in his 40s, but was in his early 20s when I conducted the inquiry, and he was one of many young Native leaders who objected to the pipeline on the very grounds I've indicated. Now he's the Premier. He and many others say, we are ready now. We think we can make this work for us. And by the way, they had a celebration in Yellowknife in June to which they invited my wife and me, a celebration of the 25th anniversary of the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Inquiry, and everybody, the Aboriginal people, the environmentalists, the government, the oil companies, they all said that was the right thing to do then. It wasn't as clear then as it appears to be now, but they say we can now be owners of the pipeline. We can be trained to have good jobs on the pipeline. We can maybe obtain as consumers cheap natural gas. There may be spin-offs. And I have been asked a number of times, what do I think about this? And I said, well, that's for them to decide. They've settled the claims, which is the condition I urge the government should meet before proceeding. And now it's up to those people who live there what they're going to do. Whether the pipeline will be from the Mackenzie Delta south along the Mackenzie Valley, whether it'll be one from Prudhoe Bay to Fairbanks and then along the route of the Alaska Highway, though those are questions that may not be resolved in the next year or two. We'll just have to await developments. I'm sorry that a lengthy answer, but...
Thank you.
Yes. Well, the question is about administrative law. It was preceded by some very nice things this gentleman said about me. I needn't repeat those. But let me just say, sir, administrative law relates to the proceedings of tribunals. They're not courts, but it might be the Liquor Control Board, might be the Workers' Compensation Board, it might be the officials in the Ministry of Forests determining who should get tree farm licenses and various forms of tenure in the forest. That's a big subject, but could I just say that when I started practicing, there were some administrative tribunals that refused to give reasons for their decisions because they didn't want to give anybody any basis for going to court and setting aside their decisions. The Labor Relations Board used not to give reasons. They just sat there, and then they said, certification is granted or it isn't. The Workers' Compensation Board used not to give reasons. They just said, your claim is allowed or it isn't allowed. And now they all give reasons. They explain things to you, and you can get a lawyer or somebody in your union to help, and you can challenge what has been done. They usually have their own internal appeal systems, and after that you can go to the courts. And those are remarkable changes. Well, the question is, what do I see as the major challenges, I guess, of the next 49 years? Well, I think I don't pretend to have considered that at length, but let me just say that I think we will be occupied, fully occupied, for a long time to come in working out the implications of the Charter of Rights. And cases like Trinity West, which involve good people on both sides with sincere beliefs, we have to continue to work those things out. May I add that the people at Trinity Western altered that contract after the case was over. And they no longer, the contract is now an affirmation of the beliefs of Jesus, who never said anything about homosexuality, and doesn't rely on St. Paul, who was a pretty fierce man when it came to that subject. And so, you know, people do think, they do consider, they do change. I think also, and this is something in BC we have to do some hard thinking about, I think we're going to be occupied for a long, long time in working out the relationship between the First Nations and the rest of us. And that's a story that is still unfolding. And those two subjects are sufficient to keep a lot of us thinking hard, and I hope creatively, for quite a few years to come.
I think we have time for one more question, right at the back.
You know, I think I'm going to have to bail out on that one. Maybe we've got some judges here. Maybe they could answer that.
Well, we'll have one more question. Right there at the back again.
Or already applicable in the Charter.
You're a law student.
And obviously a creative one. Yes, I think that's an area that needs to be explored. Since that's the last question, Ken, could I just tell you that when I was in India with the World Bank, I worked, the chairman of the commission was an American named Bradford Morris, an outstanding international public servant. And we had to consider what measures had been taken to resettle 250,000 people being displaced by a huge dam, and also the measures that India had taken to protect the environment. And we laid down in our report a series of recommendations regarding environmental protection that the World Bank then adopted. And since the World Bank has about 400 projects worldwide and disposes of more money in loans and grants every year than the budget of the British Columbia government, they are in effect for borrowing countries, which is most of the developing countries, they are the world government. If you want to get a loan, you have to subscribe to their conditions, and their conditions now include measures to protect the environment based on what Mr. Morris and I laid down. And in an odd sort of way, that's a contribution to environmental protection in many countries that may be more significant than anything that I may be likely to do in the legal profession here. But your theory is one that's been taken up in the United States, not only on the footing that individual persons have the right to a clean environment, but that forests and rivers may themselves have rights that can be protected in lawsuits by creative lawyers. So I want you to think about that.
I'll ask Mr. Justice Essen to express our thanks for this evening.
Well, it is a pleasure and an honor to be asked to thank our speaker. He and I go back quite a long way. He began his career in the law 49 years ago, first year of law at UBC. I began the next year, was called to the bar the year after him, and we have crossed paths in one way or another many times since. I've followed his career with admiration and a certain amount of envy. My career as a lawyer was a relatively mundane one. I went to the bench in 1979, indeed, then joined Tom as a colleague on the Supreme Court of British Columbia. He left a few years later in the unhappy circumstances he mentioned, and which he may remember. I tried to be of some help in talking some sense into the senior members of the judicial profession who thought that someone who spoke out beyond what they thought was proper should leave the bench. A great mistake, I thought. And Tom, that's one of the contributions he made, was by stubbornly fighting that matter. It never went to a final court issue or anything like that. In any event, I'm just going to mention one aspect of his career. You all can see what degree of ability and compassion, intelligence he brings to the law, and you're aware of his career. The added element I would like to mention is the unfailing civility and courtesy with which he has achieved all that. Unfailing as far as I know, although I think his fight with the Judicial Council brought out a pricklier side. But still, that was called for. But it really is the truth, and it's important in our society, it's important in our courts. Yes, a lot of cases are processed without a polite word being said, but that has not been the tradition, and people like Tom have made a great contribution to maintaining that tradition. I will just add, I thought of this matter when Tom and I this morning were at a very sad but very impressive event, the funeral of the late Stuart Leggett, who died earlier this week, whose career paralleled the careers of both of ours to some extent, but particularly Tom's, because he was a member of the federal house for a good many years, of the provincial house for some years, without ever having the good fortune to sit on the government side. But like Tom,